You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
Now, Don, just as is our want for people that we interview, we've interviewed an eclectic range of people and have interviewed politicians and sports people. We interviewed Miss World last week, ex-Miss World, Ann Sydney.
And also Miss Nude World.
Miss Nude World. You never forget Miss Nude World. Who would? She was Miss Nude Pornographic World. Miss Nude and Pornographic would probably be one and the same thing. And she was fantastic. And she, among other things, Don told us how to prepare for anal sex, didn't she? She did, didn't she?
She did. We also had the chairman of the racing club, Amanda Elliott, and the lady mayor.
No, you asked.
Lord Mayor.
You asked, what's her name? The Miss Nude World? Del Torre. What was her name?
Isabel.
Isabel Del Torre.
Well done.
And you found out through her bio that she was into horses, and you spoke to her about horses, and all the people listening wanted to know was just how she prepared herself for anal sex when she was doing the films and that. And I said, Don, if you ask her one more question about horses, I'll turn you off.
She's into ferrets as well.
Anyhow, so into ferrets.
And sci-fi.
Shut up, Don. So we've got another very interesting person. I don't know this man well, but I've known of him for a long time. And we thought we'd get him in. He's been involved in the fight game and nightclubs, and as a security agent for the Stars, I think. And his, just from what I gather, he is the first Australian kickboxing champion, I think, that we, when kickboxing, before it really got a hold, he pioneered it. And I've seen him around at a lot of the fights, and I know of him, and he is Dave Hedgecock.
Thank you.
How are you, Dave?
Very good. Really good.
Did I get any of that right? I sort of got some of that right.
Yes.
Did I?
Yeah. No, I was the first Australian to fight for a world title in kickboxing.
And how long ago was that, Dave?
That was 1981. Yeah, so it's a long time ago.
And did you win? I should know that.
No. I fought Steve Shepherd and I got the decision given against me. That was in Florida.
Yes.
We fought him in Florida. He was the then current world champion. It went the distance, and the decision was given to him. And we sort of complained about it because we thought that...
Hometown decision?
Yes, very much a hometown decision, unfortunately. So, and then, of course...
But that seems to happen a bit in boxing, doesn't it?
In boxing, kickboxing, particularly in the new area.
Is there any way of overcoming that?
Well, you go to the body, they have a look at the film, and then they make a decision, like the WKA was the people that were running it at that stage. And they have a look at the fights, and then they make a decision to see whether it was bona fide or not. And basically, you know, it didn't go any further. So it's just one of those things. And then I fought Billy Chow in Japan for another world title. And then, unfortunately, that went the same way, went to his decision. I had 75 kickboxing fights. Wow. I won 73 of them and lost two of them. So that was...
So Dave, the current... because I watch it. I don't know why I watch it. I'm fascinated by it. The UFC.
Yes, fantastic.
It's extraordinary.
Yes. What do you call it fantastic? I call it extraordinary. Yeah. What do you call it fantastic?
Because it's put boxing back on its...
Knocked it off its pedestal.
Yeah.
Oh, it has.
It really has. And it's become worldwide.
Dana Goodson. No, there's the bloke that runs it.
Dana White.
Is that what you're involved in? Or Muay Thai?
No, it was kickboxing when it first started. Yeah. It was above the waist only. That's when it first started.
Yes.
Then we fought. Then I went over and fought in Thailand. Had about 33 fights in Thailand with kicking knees and elbows and kicking to the legs.
And that's what UFC is.
And basically, you mix the boxing up. The only thing we weren't doing was wrestling on the ground
in the original days with
Muay Thai. And all that sort of stuff.
Muay Thai, is it?
Yeah, Muay Thai. And international rules was another way that they used to court. A few bodies start to develop over a very short period of time, and another not only having one sort of WKA world title events happening, you've got all sorts of events going on all over the world, and they all have different. You know, you're allowed to kick them when they're on the ground, like Pride. If you go to Japan and when they used to fight in Pride, if they're on the ground, you're allowed to kick them while they're on the ground.
I see, yeah.
So you're allowed to headbutt, you're allowed to do all sorts of things
Do anything.
Yeah, basically, except hit the groin and the throat and the eyes and bite.
Some people would say it's in this day and age of the society we're living in, it is ridiculous that sport's allowed to proliferate because it's a very... Yeah. And people get into the pubs, get shit-faced and pissed and then come out and think they're going to be a UFC star out on the footpath. And so it's a bit of a contradiction in terms.
It certainly is. The UFC has really taken over.
Oh, has it ever?
It really has. And it's because it's a mixture of everything. You're allowed to... Like, if you're not winning in the stand-up, they can take it to the ground. Jiu-jitsu has become quite a favourite to a lot of people as well. But the boxing and the stand-up stuff is more... Like, Dana White prefers the stand-up stuff without it going to the ground because sometimes they're rolling around and the wrestling gets a bit boring.
It does, yeah. And then the referee says, well, so you stand up, boys, and start again.
Yeah.
I did notice, and I suppose it happens often, a bloke... got knocked down, he was on his knees, and the guy kneed him in the head while he was on his knees. And he got disqualified immediately.
Exactly.
Well, he protested. He was well ahead, actually, but he got disqualified. So there are some sort of rules in it, Dave.
There are, but that's where Pride was a bit different. Pride was basically a Japanese consortment. And what happened was that in their fights, you're allowed to headbutt, you're allowed to kick them while they're on the ground, you can knee them while they're trying to get up. But it was fought in a ring, not in a cage. And that's sometimes the bodies would fall outside the ropes and bits and pieces. And so that's what I think, when it came to the cages, it turned it into a totally different...
So how in God's name did you get involved in that? How would anyone get involved in that?
What weight would you have fought at? Because you're not a big man in stature.
I fought originally at welterweight, and then I moved up
to middleweight. What weight was that?
That's 10.5 stone and 11.5 stone. Yeah, so that was what the middleweight was, and that was different in those days. But I found that when I first started doing it, that welterweight, we remember Bob Jones, who's a martial artist, he used to run kickboxing shows all over Australia. And fortunately, you know, I went down there, started to fight some of his guys, and then I beat those guys. Then we went over international and interstate and all around the world in different fights.
Were you an associate of Bob Jones, or is he older than you?
Yeah, he's older than me.
Yeah. He was the pioneer of it.
He's the pioneer of it all. He was the one who brought kickboxing to Australia.
Yeah. So how would you get into this?
Well, basically, like
how old were you?
Oh, I was in my early 30s. So
when you got into kickboxing,
basically.
So you were boxing before that,
it was something different. And because of the security industry that I was in and working, I started doing security when I was 16 and working with people.
We'll get on to the security side of it.
Bob brought this kickboxing to Australia. And then, of course, we come up with a couple of really good fighters over the years. And we've travelled overseas, Stan Loganides, Sam Greco. Yeah, they've all been blokes that have gone overseas and fought. Sam Greco actually fought in K1, which was another...
Yeah.
When they got rid of Pride, K1 stepped in. And they brought it up in Japan as well. And that was all... We fought a lot of... European guys and
he was an Australian champion.
Yep.
World champion.
Yep, and a world champion.
Yeah.
Won a world title. Yeah.
Dave, I just know you from you're just a well very well known identity.
I've been around a while.
well, you are, and you're in a couple of three industries that are just spoken about a lot because they're controversial and they're, you know, people like to. So is there? This is not a follow-on question for you. I'm sure you're not, but. Is it a has the criminal element taken over all these sports, or is it like any sport?
Now here in Australia, unfortunately, yes. A lot of the kickboxing, a lot of the Muay Thai stuff, a lot of the boxing, you're getting a lot of different people involved with bike groups getting involved.
And they try and rig the result for money, or what do they try and do?
No, what happens is we've had a few instances over the period of time where we had a busload of the Comancheros turn up one night at a fight because they had their guy was fighting the second main event,
and why would they? So they wanted him to win, obviously, because they'd backed him.
That's just what they do. But they also get very aggressive with the opponent, and they start bad mouthing. And whereas the old TV ringside days, you'd go there, everyone would sit there, and regardless of who they favoured, they were, you know, under good control, and they would barrack and enjoy a good fight. What was happening is lately is that you're getting a lot of these different people coming in, and they're getting very aggressive with the opponent, particularly if they're supporting the other fighter, and that can cause trouble with inside the crowd.
Yep.
So a lot of it's been taken, you know, over the top a little bit. They need to sit back, enjoy, and let the fighters.
So did you get caught in the middle with this by trying to pacify or even challenge the bikies daunting task to do that.
It is a daunting task, but when I was running the security industry that I was running, I had close to 500 people working for me. We worked in just about every state in Australia. And of course, we had the numbers, and a lot of the guys that were working with me were ex-champions too, and ex-fighters, and a lot of kickboxers, a lot of boxers, you know, just some very tough, hard guys. So we could, match them, but things have changed.
So would you be aware, say that busload of Comancheros were coming, would you be aware before the actual event that they would be coming? Or so what I'm trying to say, how would you staff an organiser? How would you staff that particular event if there are...
For most of the fight nights that we have a minimum of 12 to 15 security guards. We had 25 guards there for that night.
You were aware of what was going to happen.
Well, we knew that
premonition.
The premonition is a possibility. Yeah. So therefore, you take a few conditions. You make things a little bit arranged a little bit differently. But what happened was they came in. They conducted themselves well, and they only came in for the one fight to watch their fighter fight. And a lot of these guys that are now training have got associations with bike groups, and it's not detrimental to them, but it's not detrimental to the bike groups. But what happens is when they come in, they get a bit supportive and they start bagging the other side. And that's what we've got to... We sort of position people. One group's over there, one group's over there, one group's over there. And we want them all to keep separate and just, watch the fights and enjoy the fights.
Do they come armed? Or do you? You might want to answer this, but do your people, are they armed? Not licensed to carry?
No, security guards. You can get some security guards are licensed to carry.
Yes.
But that very unusual here in Australia.
The bikie groups, they'd come in with
scanners that they have to come through. We've got wands. Yep. We go over them with the wands and everything else like that. And if it makes a noise, we search the bags and everything else. So it's been pretty good. But there was only 2 years ago, there was a shooting out the front.
One of the stadiums
where the guy died, unfortunately. Yep. They fired five or six shots and they come running through the door and they shot one bloke in the leg, and we picked him up and carted him into the kitchen to get him out of the way. And it was just one of those things, but it was a dead set.
Dave, did you start doing doors at nightclubs? Is that how you started?
Yeah.
Would you consider yourself a racist, if that's the case, in other words? I remember the door bitches that used to be around. Yeah. I don't know if they're still around, but, depending on how you looked, determined as to whether you got in or whether you're...
No, that's not racist. That's profiling.
That's a form of racism.
No, social profiling, people.
You
could turn up looking like that and he'd say, you can't come in.
That's right.
No, you look like a fucking idiot.
It was more or less the look And if they portrayed themselves, once they got inside and started to carry on a bit, well, we moved them out straight away.
Did you get them into the line? This is what used to intrigue me. There would be a line.
Yeah, that's right.
And other people would just walk up to these guys like yourself at the head of the line, and then they'd go. The rest of us were standing still in line.
Yeah, no, but that's happened to you and me, Don. Yeah. I've walked up and they say, "You want to come in? Come in."
Yeah,
that's just
well. The last time I seen Sam at the fights, I seen him coming. I said, "Come straight through, Sam. The table's
too.
Over here."
You did indeed. You did indeed.
Because I mean, when personalities and people like that are well known, they shouldn't have to wait in line, you know, because if they...
Yeah, sure, we don't want to do it on mix with the riffraff, don't we?
What I'm trying to get to, yep. You instruct, you know, going back to your early days at the nightclubs, were you instructed by the owners of that nightclub that, you know, let certain people in, they've got we want an image, and so we want these type of people in there?
Yes, that happened.
So did you have any problems doing that?
Occasionally, yes. I mean, well, the Morans, I had several problems with the Morans.
Yeah.
You know, punched on with them several times. Jason drove past Bombay Rock, which we used to do in the old days, and fired 3 or 4 shots at us at the front door. But then he came into the boxing gym in a Beckett Street where I used to train people on the Monday and said, "I'm sorry." I hit him on the chin and said, "Well, now we're even."
it's unbelievable, isn't it? It is extraordinary.
What about as far as races go? I'm talking about people, but then you got different races. Were you allowed to let different people in or...?
Yes. Look, it's... So unfortunately, what you do get a lot of now is you get different dance parties where you get dance parties, and they get Chinese people, you get Aussies, Australians, you get black people,
Islanders,
you get all sorts of islands. It's just a mixed, we're very much a mixed race, and I think because of the mixed race that we have here in Australia, it's acceptable. You know, you don't stop anyone back in because of their nationality.
And you're on pardon the expression, a kicking to nothing, because if you stop people, certain people, types, like, stop people coming in because you think, oh, this is not going to go well, then you get accused and branded, and then the fights actually start outside before you start in.
Yeah, exactly right.
Dave, you must have been able to handle yourself. You're not a big... No, hang on.
Don,
you're not
please.
A big man.
No.
Now, you would be confronted, I should imagine.
Very often.
Would you be aware of... Is there a pattern to a confrontation? You know, do you, as an experienced person, there's going to be a confrontation happening soon because of A, B, C?
Mm-hmm.
Or does a confrontation happen just like that?
No, sometimes you can see it coming. And so
you're prepared.
You prepare yourself for it, but then sometimes you don't see it coming.
So what are the steps?
It just happens.
What are the steps?
Well, usually you can see the people that get a little bit intoxicated.
Intuition.
They start to get a little bit loud, and they start to get a little bit pushy. They start to stand in front of people that are sitting down, and you go over and say, "Listen, mate, everyone's got to sit down. You know, just sit yourself down, relax, you know, and just slow down on the drink." You know, because if they keep drinking and keep getting drunk or they get out of control, then we've got to remove them out. And sometimes that creates a problem.
So do you have you're putting a new guy on in security.
Yep.
Do you sit them down and go through the various steps of this is what
you've
got to do or how you work this? Because it's a fairly sophisticated industry when you get into it.
It's getting that way now, and with the training now that everyone has to have a license, you've got to go into the training schools. And so I used to do a lot of seminars at the training schools and just enlighten them of certain why things that take place. You know, when someone comes in, someone tries to walk through, someone tries to jump the queue, you know, da-da-da, all the rest of it, you know. Some people just don't want to pay to get in, or they just think they can just walk in, you know. So you've got to, and you try to alert everybody on how their actions you have to take place. You pull them up. Hey, sorry, this is what's got to happen. You can't come through. And, you know, this has got to happen. And
never forget
this. So what is the first line? You go up and you talk to them, obviously. You try and speak the problem through. But when do you start? This is getting out of hand.
You've seen this, mate. You've seen this.
We
were talking in another segment about not going out on the town. You said, "Oh, no, when I was disciplined, I didn't go out in the town." We used to go out in the town.
Of course.
And you could see how it all started. In fact, people say to me, "Settle down, mate." To me, which is right, fair enough, and you can see how all that escalates. People are proud, and they've got women with them, and they don't want to be made a fool of in front of. Exactly. And then don't worry about Dave here. It's not the size of the dog in the fight, mate. It's the size of the fight.
Security man,
the dog.
Have you got to have some proficiency or a qualification as far as a martial arts, boxing, or self defence, or anything?
Well, I prefer everyone to have some sort of an idea as to how to defend themselves. And you know, preferably, you know a little bit about and read the persons, because sometimes you get some people very cunning. Some people they go, oh well, okay, mate. So bang.
hang on. Yeah, what do you mean cunning?
Very cunning, sneak go. They're very quiet, and then all of a sudden, and they walk up and get a little bit close. Yeah.
And then they let it go.
Oh, you know. So you've got to be able to read the individual. Yeah. Like I always say, buddy, please. Yeah, stay
distance,
back there.
Yeah, that's good.
Oh, keep distance.
Yeah, just keep your distance.
Do you carry anything like those truncheon things that coppers carry?
No, he carries his fist.
Just your fist.
Yeah.
Now, a huge problem would be drugs. Like, I'm not sure what it was like when you started. Yeah. Not you taking them. I'm talking about the patrons. Yeah. But it's so rife now that
seen such a change from the you know, 60s, 70s through to the 80s. And then in the 90s, it totally just...
It just went mad.
Because they were being badly affected by the drugs.
And that's the problem, isn't
it? And how does this change them? Are they more violent?
Yes.
And more
Are
confident?
They stronger? Do they get...
Yeah, they're a bit hard. Yeah, yes. They tend to want to... There's no fear.
Turn up on the ice, ice, mate.
It's but how do they handle themselves physically if that's the case and they're on drugs?
Look, you know, so many people, if you're a trained professional and you know what you're doing.
I'm talking about the person who's on the drugs.
Yeah, the person's on the drugs.
Are they stronger?
They get Dutch courage.
They just get aggressive and they really come and they want to shout at you. Yeah. And, of course, look what they do. They lean their head forward and they try to talk to you bad. You know, I mean, they're opening, but they're, you know, when you've got to turn them around and put them down or take them out or armbar them or whatever, whichever way you can do it, you get them out.
You've got a tremendous discipline before, in case you get yourself into legal trouble and people, so if you throw people
So what people then litigious. Reverse it and charge you for assault or bodily harm or something along that
line? Yes, well, unfortunately, I remember we were working at Casey's one time, a nightclub over there, the old Casey's. This young kid came up the stairs. He was the part of the promotion. He didn't have his ID, didn't have his tags, didn't have anything else. And so we said, look, mate, you're going to have your ID if to get into, you know, otherwise you've got to pay. Anyway, so he walked away and then all of a sudden he came back and he tried to rush through. And one of the guys grabbed hold of him. There was a little bit of a scuffle and he fell down the stairs. That kid smashed his head on the step and died.
Oh, shit.
Oh, wow.
Oh, shit.
And it was just, you know, and then of course there's a big court case, you know, because the security guy grabbed him and there was a bit of a scuffle and they both fell down, but he fell down backwards. Oh. The security guy fell down forwards.
Yes.
But anyway, it all went to court and all got, you know, heard out and everything else and the film, because you've got cameras on the front door, and it showed what exactly happened. It was a terrible accident. Now, no one wants that to happen. But then again, we've had people come, and I keep saying to the security guys, never put your hands in your pocket. Always keep yourself hands-free and keep distance. Yeah. And some guy that had been already put out came back and wanted to try to get in, and they said, look, mate, please, you can't come in. You've had too much drink. Go away. Bang, he pulled a knife and shivved him, you know. And, of course, he was in hospital for you know, got badly, just, you know, badly stabbed two or three times, and the bloke just took off.
Yeah,
so it happens.
So can you get workers' compensation for your employees?
Well, yeah.
Or is it a high premium?
Well, it's hard to get. The insurance is going up and up and up because of that's the probability of there being a risk of something going wrong.
So what? So David Hook's got Hook's got. Well, I don't know if he got king hit or if he got. No, he didn't get. He fell over.
Was that by security?
Yeah,
yes, it was by security. Oh, we were doing that club at the time.
Were you?
Yeah. And it was one of my guys that actually...
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
So I didn't know that.
And he was a... And what happened was...
He didn't get king hit. No, he didn't.
No, he didn't get king hit. No, what happened was he was really aggressive inside.
He was.
He was obviously drunk. and very aggressive. And then, of course, what happens if we wouldn't let him in back in? So he walked away, came around. But then when there was some sort of a fight, upstairs. Outside around the corner. Yep. And the security got involved, and David Higgs hit the security guy, and the security guy hit him back.
Yeah.
And he fell down, did he?
He did, and that closed that venue, didn't it?
It never opened again.
Never opened again, no. Yeah.
So do you handle, beside hotel security or venue security, do you do anything with visiting dignitaries?
Ooh. Well, yeah, I have done. We did the Rolling Stones, the Voodoo Lounge concert, myself and Bob Jones, Fleetwood Mac, you know. Billy Joel Cocker.
God.
Yeah. So what? Whenever these stars go out somewhere, they have, they've got to go with security. They just can't go.
Some of them want to. Some of them don't want to. Like Bill Morty, he brought George Foreman out, and in those days it was a TV. He came out to promote
cooker things.
Yes, the cooker things, but
the grill.
The grill. And of course, Bill Morty, he had him there as well as going around. We had a few dinners and he'd come and give a talk and all the rest of it. And I remember at the Underworld gym, we had I asked him if he would come down and this kid's for cancer. And he said, yeah, he said he would come down. So I picked him up and we drove down and he walked into the Underworld gym and there was about 300 or 400 people there, parents with their kids and also. And he sent the driver back to his apartment to bring back these boxes. And these boxes were full of T-shirts. And he'd give every kid and every parent a T-shirt. And then on the front page of the Herald Sun, there was a photo of him like this, with a kid sitting on each bicep. And he was just an unbelievable, just a perfect gentleman, you know. He said, that was beautiful. He said, you know, thank you for letting me know about that. Thank you for coming and pick me up. And then, of course, myself and Stuart Duncan were in America in watching a fight there, trying to get a couple of people involved in, because Stuart Duncan's a promoter. And of course, George Foreman seen us, and he was doing the commentary. He took his headphones off, come across and walked over and shook hands. So he's never, ever forgotten.
So this was obviously well after Muhammad Ali knocked him, beat him. Ever speak to him about that? He must have been philosophical about, because I watched the – everyone watched the fight. Course, I thought I know I was a great Ali fan, but I thought there's no way that man will stand up against George Foreman. But
he did.
It was extraordinary.
Outsmarted him.
Did he ever speak about how he was outsmarted?
He gave nothing but praise to Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
And he said, I got angry. He said, I fought with anger. He said, I was really trying to knock him out with every punch I threw. He said, I just lost tight.
Yeah.
He said, and he took advantage of it. And he caught me with some good punches. He said, that's why he's a great champion. That's why he's the greatest champion that ever.
Probably do you think that added to his predicament, Muhammad Ali, the pounding he copped in that particular fight?
Not just that.
No.
He copped a few other poundings in a few more fights. Wow, him and Joe Frazier, they went for it. The three fights.
That in Manila one.
Oh, yeah.
Ali absorbed a lot of punishment Foreman hit him in those few rounds.
Blokes like Spinks belted him. His Burbeck.
Larry Holmes.
Larry Holmes. I was watching a doco, you might have seen it on Ali, and Holmes said, I told him, he said, please don't, he was my hero and I didn't want to beat him up and I was beating him up and I said, please stay in your corner, wind it up, don't come out. It's a fascinating, just the not the corruption in the sport, but you'd never know. So what about the drugs as far as in the sport? Is it well-regulated UFC? Do they do drug tests?
The martial arts board, myself, Bernie Barmer and a couple of
Bernie Barmer,
we all put, that was when the first boxing board, combat sports board was put together. And so we had to make rules and regulations, myself, Bob Jones, Bob Todd, a lot of people that had a lot to do with boxing, all sat down and we started to work out the rules and regulations about how we should do this and should do that. The weigh-ins, you need at least, in the old days, you'd weigh in a couple of hours before.
And then put on half a stone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And now, so you've got to weigh in 24 hours before, but you can't be more than 6 or 7 kilos over the weight that you weighed in on.
Yep.
But yesteryear, that didn't matter. You could put on whatever you wanted to put on, and then you sometimes... Sam Solomon, we fought... what was his name? A very good fighter. Anyway, he put on 13 pounds. Nearly one stone.
That's extraordinary.
From when he first weighed in. So, and I thought, well, that's not.
That'd be fluid, though, surely.
Well, fluid, carbs, food, whatever. Yeah. Whittaker, it was. And he put on 13 pounds. Because when you weigh in just prior to the fight, which you have to do, he was 13 pounds over. But he made the weight 24 hours before. He put the weight on, whereas Sam Solomon didn't put the weight on. He couldn't put the weight on.
Whittaker's name? Well known.
Yeah, very well known. Yeah.
Very good fighter.
Yeah, very good fighter.
Can't think of his name.
Yeah. Not Roger.
Not Roger. You idiot. Do you drug test for performance enhancing drugs?
Well, you do the drug test. Yeah.
They worry about it too much? Eye to it.
No, they do. Overseas, in particular, here they do the drug test as well. If they think someone's on something, they take a sample. The doctor's there doing all that sort of stuff.
Dave, the American boxers, they used to fascinate me, especially the heavyweights. They were really ripped, Now, they had to be on. They had to be on steroids back in those days. It was just impossible. To build your muscle and your physique naturally like the way they were.
Yeah. Well, Evander Holyfield.
I was just going to say what a great looking man.
Oh, man.
And so how did he get away with doing that?
Well, he used a lot of not
supplements,
drugs, but a lot of protein stuff.
Yeah.
And he told me that he was doing some sort of fruit and wheat and grass, and you'd cook it a certain way, or you'd put in water a certain way. And he found this stuff, and he said it just used to rip him. He said,
really?
He just used to drink this stuff. It wasn't a drug. It was all mixture of a concoction of stuff that he put together. And he said he'd train and he'd sweat like nothing else. He said he was just ripped. Just tore all the fat away.
Because the fighters nowadays, especially in the heavyweights, the big boys from Russia and Tyson Fury, they've got a more natural
physique.
Natural physique, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Pernell Whittaker. Pernell. He was an absolute
sensation.
Sam fought him.
Yep.
Sam Solomon.
Yeah, fought him. We lost the fight over there, but everyone booed and they all thought that we won the fight.
Yeah.
But the thing was, he was 13 pounds over.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
When he stepped into the ring. And
So just getting back to the people that you did security for, did the groups like Pink Floyd, or did you say?
Fleetwood Mac.
Fleetwood Mac. And the Rolling Stones, did they embrace you or take you into their group, or did they, were arm's length from you?
No, always fantastic. And because me and Bob were always personal with them. And Richard Norton.
Yep.
Richard Norton, partner of Bob's, he was looking after Linda Ronstadt and looking after a lot of people in and around all over America. He's made a lot of movies and stuff like that. He used to work with us as well
You along after these shows
good people.
What were their and did they require you to do anything?
No, they
demands
did their own
on
thing.
You, or did you get any off cuts, or did they let a couple of
Well, I remember I was looking after what's that lady's name? Oh, I forgot her name now. She's but she was pretty heavy into the drugs. She came out here with a concert with the guy that used to get out and sing in a pair of nappies.
Whitney Houston.
Not Whitney Houston.
The guy came out in nappies.
No, the singer. He used to come out on the stage and sing a song in a nappy.
Did he?
The long-haired guy.
What's his name?
Tony Tim.
No, Alice Tim. No.
I'm shocking with names. It's
just, and there's the woman, was she...
Linda Love someone?
Not Linda Lovelace.
No, not Linda Lovelace.
It was Linda Love, Ronstadt. Her name. She was an actress as well, and she's a singer as well.
Oh, wow.
And she said, and we're at the Crank Casino, she said, they hired the whole... cut out the whole room, and they had a big party there. And yeah. I've never seen so many drugs in my life.
Yeah, no, I know that. I'll Google that as well. I know that. Yeah. I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, I just can't remember.
I can't either.
What about the VFA days? Didn't Bob Jones do security for Sandringham and Port in some of those rugged encounters?
Yes, we all did.
What do you mean you all did?
Me, Bob...
So what would you do? Escort the umpires, or were you circulating in the crowd, or what was the go?
We'd take notice of where the particular problems were.
In the crowd?
The crowd, and then we'd move our group together and intermix and say, hey, you know, drop off, slow down, or else you're out, you know, and done.
And there were, just certain VFA games that you would attend? So which games were they?
Croxton Park.
Now, hang on. Croxton Park didn't have a team in the VFA.
No, not the VFA, neither. But there was a YCW, you know, the Preston Association.
You'd go out there in suburban football?
Yeah.
Rubbish.
Yeah, we've got a very interesting bystander who's just wandered in called Phil Cleary.
Hello, how are you?
This is Dave Hedgecock. Now, Phil would know all about what's going on in the VFA. He probably belted more people than you have, Dave. So they didn't have any... What were some of the more extravagant things they asked you to do, if any? Who did you did it for? Fleetwood Mac?
Fleetwood Mac.
They were good
Rolling
people,
Stones.
You said?
Yeah. They were really good.
Yeah.
And they were very... the drummer... Keith Fleetwood. A couple of times he actually was quite funny because he grabbed a coffee jar and he tipped a bit of what I thought was coffee into his hand.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so that was a bit strange, but most of them were all pretty well. They're really well behaved, and you know, they did their stuff away from us, you know, whatever they wanted to do, they did their stuff away from us.
They didn't ask you to wander in, and you didn't. They didn't ask you to wander in and join them. No. You wouldn't have been in that, Dave. You're not a drug man.
Never. No. Don't drink. I don't smoke. I've never done drug in my life.
Good on you. No, it's fantastic.
So tell me, what were the Rolling Stones doing?
Yeah, sorry,
the Rolling Stones took you where?
Yeah, the Rolling Stones. They actually came down to the Carousel. I used to.
What, down in Albert Park?
In Albert Park, I used to.
Geez, that'd be jumping.
I was one of the ones that was. The owner there at that particular time, and I asked them would they like to come down, and they did come down, but the trouble is everybody just went and everyone wanted to come and talk to them. And actually Mick turned around and he said, look thank you, but I think we'll want to go home. I said, no worries. Jumped in the cars, we took them back home, back to the hotel. But they come down, spent about 2.5 hours there.
It'd be hard for them to get privacy on tour, wouldn't it?
They stay, a couple of times, put it this way, Fleetwood Mac, he wanted to, he said, have you got any bookstores here? And in Swanson Street was the Space Age bookstore. And he wanted to, he was very much into the Space Age sort of stuff and what was going on there. And I said, the only place I could think of that is up in Swanson Street on the corner. So he said, can you take us there? I said, yeah, of course I can. So we took him in there and he walked around and had a look, and he bought a heap of stuff from the premises and that he wanted, and bits and pieces. Some of the Shirley Bassey. I said to her, I said, Shirley, I've got my mother. She's just turned 80, her and her aunties, and there's two people there that are 100. Her and her aunties and sisters are coming, and they're at that table. And she said, what table? And I said, table number 2 or number 3, whatever it was. And when she came out, and she said, Elaine Hedgecock, this is for you. And she actually sung a song and dropped down on one knee to basically tour. And that was just perfect. I mean,
that would
just
be in the 90s. I thought you'd be rather.
That was at the Crown Casino.
At the '90s, because I interviewed Shirley Bassey. Yeah. I was doing beautiful interviews person. for the Sun in those days, before it was the Herald Sun.
Yep.
And I was one of, I'm just telling you this, I was one of about 15 people, and I had a baseball cap on, and she was as grumpy as buggery when I went into the room, because they said, next, and then I said, yes, I said, I had a little tape recorder, I said, now when that's on, I said, we're on the record.
Record,
and, and she said, get on with it, and I said, oh, right, I thought this is not going to last long, so I've got this on tape, I said to her, I thought I'll have one crack at this, and I said, what criteria would I have to fulfil in order for you to go out with me? And she said, what did you say? And I said, what criteria? I've got this. And she said, take that fucking cap off for a start. And then she threw her head back and laughed, and I spoke to her for half an hour.
So
and
that was a little bit like,
fantastic.
A bit like that film. Did you pinch that off that film where...
what's nothing's original about me.
Notting Hill, the film Notting Hill. Remember that press conference where he asked...
No, I didn't. I don't think... Notting Hill was out then, was it?
Well, they might have pinched it off you.
They might have.
Yeah.
Now, she was wonderful.
She was.
Unbelievable.
Yes, yeah,
and was. And I got to take my mum backstage at the end of the night, and she wished her a happy birthday. And the same with... Tom Jones, he said, where can I go and have a... He finished the concert, so I said, I'll come to Lazar's. We run the place, there's a piano bar upstairs. And so...
I've been there too.
Yeah,
You've probably thrown me out of there too.
No, I've
been up to Lazar's. A restaurant. He had a restaurant up on the top floor, didn't you?
That's right. And they used to have the piano bar up there for night time.
They did.
And he came up there, and of course he just wanted champagne, and the owner up there was ecstatic that he had Tom Jones in his building, so he was giving him every bit of champagne. He went over, and he was talking to the bloke that was playing the piano and doing some singing. The bloke hopped up, he hopped down, played the piano and sung a couple of songs.
Fantastic.
Upstairs.
It's extraordinary. So you were part of Lazar's?
Yes.
Yeah. And you were part of Casey's?
Carousel.
Carousel, yeah. Yeah, I used to go to the Carousel. Yeah. I went to all the joints.
Good spot.
No wonder I've heard of you, Dave. They say don't cause any trouble, Sam, or funny. That man there will spank you. it's fantastic. Now, so we've got. Do you keep an eye on what's happening with Tim Zoo?
Yes.
Now he's here.
There's a lot of gyms. There's a lot of places opening up. A lot of people are now doing UFC. Like we have a lot of functions on where the UFC Cage fights are coming on more and more and more. And as I said, the crowds are getting bigger and bigger because the boxing's starting to pick who they want to fight and who they don't. It's not like it was, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago, where the good fighters would fight the good fighters. You know, if you were, they're all looking for easy fights, whereas the UFC stuff is pretty full on. They're all starting it, they're all going at it full time, and they're
big
all
money,
the Australian guys. Oh, this Sunday they're fighting.
Big money in it? It's through pay to watch?
Pay to watch, yeah. They get 700, 800 people there.
I book it on
the pay for
main event or whatever.
They're huge.
Pay $60 every time.
Yeah.
So Big Daddy, Big Mummy, I call him. Big Daddy got belted by. Who did he get belted by? Big Daddy Brown is his name.
Maurice Smith. He fought John. What was his name? That was the first world heavyweight title in USC.
Yep.
And he spent 6 months out here with me, training with me.
Yeah.
And then we went over there and he fought and he won the first USC world title. So Murray Smith, the black guy from America.
Yeah, and Dante, who fought Tyson Fury. So it's a fascinating industry Dave.
It certainly is.
And I've seen you around, and we had Mick Gatto in here chatting. I suppose you're all in it together. It's a fantastic thing.
Mick and all those guys were all younger, and I used to know them from when they were kids to growing up in the boxing. Mick used to train with Kevin Waterson down at the Beckett Street Gym, which is where we used to be. Me and Stretch Anderson used to train all the time.
Stretch Anderson?
Mm.
God, I remember him from TV ringside. So he moved up to Myrtleford or somewhere, didn't he?
No, he was always in Preston Reservoir.
Was he?
Where he lived, yeah. He committed suicide, you know.
Oh,
that,
no.
Don't you? Yeah.
Did he?
Yeah. Yeah, what happened was, well, it wasn't suicide actually, it was a 1983, January the 3rd, Brash's shopping centre, at the Greensboro Shopping Centre in Brash's. I'd arrived home, I had a house in Greensboro. I arrived home and I seen a lot of his golf bags and stuff like that. I went in and spoke to my wife, Jackie. I said, oh, where's Trevor? She said, he came in, I made him a cup of tea. He rang his mother. He said, but David, there's something going on, because he had depressed. A couple of tears in his eyes.
Yeah.
And she said, please wait until David comes home. He said, no, I've got to go, I've got to go. And he left and he drove around to Greensboro Shopping Centre, walked into Brash's, and then he actually murdered his wife then murdered his wife's girlfriend.
Oh, no.
I won't mention their names because people might listen. Yeah. But he shot Pam four times, and then he shot Jan once in the head. And then as I've come through the door at the Brash's and everyone's running out, the screaming, as I come through the door, he's looked at me and said, put the gun in his mouth and shot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so...
Gee, that would last with you for... I mean,
oh, I've never forgotten it. And I scooped him up and I'm sitting on the ground and I've got him on my arms and his heart was beating. And I'm saying, someone call an ambulance, but the police got there sooner than the ambulances did.
Yep.
And they're all pulling their guns out and pointing it at me, and I said, look, someone call an ambulance. And this detective in a suit, he walked over. I didn't realise the gun was right next to me.
Oh, wow.
Sitting on the thing. So they didn't know what had taken place. Oh, yeah. So they kicked the gun away. He said, listen, just let him go. The ambulance is here now. And let explain. I was, so that was that. And unfortunately,
what an experience.
He was fascinating. Can I just go back? He was he used to fascinate me on ringside.
Mate, he was unbelievable.
How tall was he?
6 foot three and a half.
And what weight did he fight at?
He actually fought at light heavy. He was only
11. Oh, I thought he fought much lighter than that.
He fought a heavyweight. He beat...
No, I didn't think he fought heavy. I thought he...
He fought, won the Australian heavyweight title. He beat the Australian champion.
Well, he must have put on weight, because when he started, he was skinny.
He moved up weight divisions. But he was as skinny as all get.
That's what I mean. When he started, he was skinny.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And he fought in the real lower weights and had the reach advantage.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he was a terrific fighter. And
what, now, he'd be a good fighter because of his height or his reach? He was unique, didn't have shoulders.
It was his attitude. He had a no-defeat attitude and he had a no-fear attitude. You know, we used to bounce together and stuff like that, and there'd be 20 blokes across the road. You know, and he'd say, oh, come on, let's go across. Well, no, let them come across to us, Trevor, you know. And he'd say, no, let's us go. And he'd go across, so you'd have to go with him. He just didn't fear anything. He had no fear whatsoever. And, mate, I've never seen a bloke... He one of the biggest punchers, you know.
Really?
Oh yeah, he used to knock people out left, right, and centre.
So when he shot those people, and obviously he suffered from depression, did he, or what?
He was depressed, very depressed. On New Year's Eve,
I don't know, I suppose.
A couple of the places we were working, and it just went New Year's Eve, and everyone was celebrating, and he turned around, and he was going to walk away. I said, no, King, what are you doing? Stay here. You know, he said, no, I'm going to go. I said, no, stay here, mate, can't stay. And I could see I think he was going to go home and either try to do something to his wife or whatever.
Yeah.
I got no idea. I said, no, mate, you're not going. You're staying here. He said, David, I'm going.
Get out.
And I said, no, you're not. And he said, you get out of my way, though. I said, no. I said, if you're going to go, you're going to have to fight me because you're not going. You know, and I kept him there. But 3 days later.
Wow. Okay, well now, Dave, Frank Ropus, and he was a...
Lovely bloke.
Yeah, they were the big names.
They were great, yeah. In fact, and Matty Ropus.
Matty Ropus.
Matty Ropus. And Frank was very good too.
And Barry Michael.
Barry Michael.
They had some great fights on those.
Barry was a trip. Barry actually brought Dana Goodson over.
Yep.
And then Dana Goodson, he asked me if I give him a job, so I gave him a job bouncing. He used to bounce down at Bombay Rock for us. He used to train with me. And I trained him. We went up to Sydney and fought Lee Rice in a kickboxing match, and he won the Australian kickboxing champion heavyweight title in there. Then he went down and we got him into the Fitzroy gym, and he opened up his own gym there and started to train a lot of good fighters.
I went to all your venues, Bob. I've been to. And who are some of the footballers that used to Dermot?
Dermot Berrington.
Who were some of your regular customers?
Yeah, good people.
Yeah.
North Melbourne.
Wayne Carey.
Yeah, Wayne Carey.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah, we used to come down saloon all the time.
Oh, the saloon. Yeah. Jason Dunstall owned saloon.
Jason Dunstall. Yeah,
he owned the saloon. Part of it.
The Hawthorne full forward, what was his name?
Dunstall.
Jason Dunstall, he was a part owner there.
Yeah.
And when they went broke and they closed down, he was the only one that rang me and said, "We owe you money." And he gave me a check.
No, he's a good man.
Absolute gentleman.
No, he is too. He's a good man.
Joe, just to fill a talking, why back in the 50s when I started following the boxing, a lot of Aboriginal boxers,
yes,
there doesn't seem to be that many. Am I right in saying?
100% right.
Why is that?
I think it's a generation of they just want handouts to a certain extent. They want to look, just Sonny Booth. Was a TV ringside fighter.
Lionel
Rose and all those guys. Johnny
Fabish. But I'm going back. George Bracken.
Bracken, oh, that's
the Sands brothers. Yeah. You know, this is in the early 50s. Yeah. I mean, these blokes were sensational.
Weren't they? They're physically really great athletes.
Sonny Bill Williams. Is he in New Zealand?
New Zealand. He's Maori.
He's not indigenous.
He's an island. So it's just the fact that they, you know, what, the. It's too easy for them now, do you think?
I just think, yeah. I don't think there's too many out there that I... Well, we used to have a lot of Aboriginals come into the gym and train and as kids. And I used to do a couple of seminars and go and train some of these kids. But they drop off. They just...
They were exceptionally quick with their hands, weren't they?
Some of them were great athletes, you know.
Well, look, great athletes, Dave... Yeah. This is fascinating, as I say. Great to put a face to the name. And I've seen you around. As I say, haven't been in your company a hell of a lot, but I've seen you around, and you're an institution, and you're a definite man of interest in this city. And it was great of you to come in.
No, great to have
Don me. Dave Hedgecock, he's a star. And don't mix with him, because don't worry about how big he is. He'll build the shit out of you at the drop of a hat. Thank you very much, Dave.
Thank you.
Oh, no, wrong one.